Controlled our passions inwardly and have subdued our ego. Then divine love grows in us, and with it love of our fellow men. But the love of God has to be won through self-discipline, which we have neglected to practice. We have forgotten the aim of life, to realize and see God. That is our whole difficulty, and that is why, when Jesus asks us to love our enemies, we are unable to obey him, even if we wish to do so. We do not know how. We cannot love God and hate our neighbor. If we really love God, we will find him in everyone. So how can we hate another? If we harm anyone, we harm ourselves. If we help anyone, we help ourselves. All feelings of separateness, exclusiveness, and hatred are not only morally wrong, they are ignorant because they deny the existence of the omnipresent Godhead. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Until we actually reach oneness with God, it is, of course, quite natural that we should have misunderstandings and quarrels with one another. But we must not let our resentments stay with us, or they will eat into our hearts like cancer. Christ, who, like all truly spiritual teachers, was a great psychologist, taught that we must be reconciled as soon as possible with our brother, even before we offer our gift to God. Anyone who has practiced meditation will immediately understand how sound this teaching is. Suppose someone has wronged you, and you feel irritated. When you begin to meditate, what happens? Prayer and meditation concentrate the mind and intensify the emotions. Consequently, the molehill or irritation becomes a mountain of anger. You start to imagine terrible things about the person who has wronged you. You find yourself unfit to pray and meditate, unable to come to God until you are sincerely reconciled with your brother. There is only one way to feel sincerely reconciled, and that is to try to see God in all beings and to love him in all. If you have been angry with your brother, pray for him as you pray for yourself. Pray that both of you may grow in understanding and devotion to God. At once you will gain spiritually. But if you keep your anger in your heart, you will hurt yourself as well as your brother. It is taught in Buddhism and in Vedanta that it is a man's duty to pray for others before he prays for himself. He is asked to send a thought of goodwill towards all beings before he offers himself to God. Such a practice is a significant step towards the attainment of love for our neighbor and for God. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him. Christ is teaching us that we must not waste our time and energy on quarrels and resentment, but should reestablish ourselves as quickly as possible in the thought of God. To realize God is our purpose in life. Therefore, we should try to maintain ourselves in his consciousness with as few and as short interruptions as possible. Give up all vain talk, the Upanishads tell us. Know the Atman alone. The desire to argue and quarrel is a sign of ego. If you want to find God, you must suppress the ego and humble yourself, not before your adversary, but before God within him. Never submit to a powerful adversary because you fear the consequences of disagreement. That would be cowardice. But discriminate between principles and opinions. There is a Hindu saying, say yea, yea to everyone, but keep your own seat firm. Do not compromise on ideals and principles. But when it comes to opinions, appreciate views differing from yours and accept them when they merit it. Swami Turiyananda used to say, stubbornness is not strength. Stubbornness merely hides one's weakness. Strong is he who is flexible like steel and does not break. Strong is he who can live in harmony with many people and heed opinions other than his own. If you are intolerant of the opinions of others and stubbornly insist on having your own way, you will suffer the consequences until you have paid the uttermost farthing. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her, hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. It hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery. Here Jesus is speaking of the necessity for self-mastery, for mental control of the passions, particularly lust. Merely refraining from lustful actions is not enough. Lustful thoughts must be checked too. There are, of course, many teachers who would say, yes, indeed, we agree. An inner check on the passions is certainly necessary. Our young people must use self-control. But very few of those teachers could answer why self-control is needed. That is why young people today question them and even begin to suspect that the teachers hate pleasure for its own sake because they are too old to take part in it themselves. What does it matter what we do, say the young, as long as we don't harm anyone else? They're perfectly honest and sincere about this. It's no use telling them that their pleasures are wicked or that it is wrong to be happy because they will never believe you. Their instincts tell them that you are lying. When you talk about sin, they will disregard you. But if you stop telling them that they are sinful and begin to tell them that God is inside each one of them, if you hold up the ideal of God realization and show them that the struggle for self-discipline is hard but exciting, like training for athletics. If you show them that by dissipating themselves, they are cutting themselves off from the greatest joy in life, a joy far greater than all their worldly pleasures, then you will be talking a language they can understand. They may be skeptical, but some of them, at least, will want to try spiritual life for themselves. The ideal of continence has been so misrepresented in this country that nearly everybody thinks of it as something negative, as a don't. Don't be incontinent, the churches tell us. It is a sin. In this way, for the great majority of people who instinctively hate don'ts, the idea of continence has become unattractive and associated with repression, gloom, and cowardice, while the idea of incontinence becomes more and more attractive and is associated with freedom, fun, and courage. This terrible and destructive misunderstanding, if not corrected, will eventually poison the whole national life. Unless boys and girls can be taught the vital connection between continence and spiritual life, they will gradually waste their powers. They will lose the possibility of spiritual growth, and with it, all real creativeness, all real awareness. Continence is not repression. It stores up energy and applies that energy to better uses. It is not an end in itself, but an indispensable means of freeing the mind from distracting passions and keeping it in the consciousness of God. Sex energy controlled becomes spiritual energy. To one who is continent, spiritual growth comes quickly and easily. Many people think that by being continent, they will lose the greatest pleasure the world has to offer. But the strange fact is that they will not really lose anything. As the sex energy is conserved and as it becomes transformed, they will find a new and much more intense pleasure growing inside themselves. And that is the joy of coming closer and closer to union with God. In the Bhagavad Gita, the state of mind of the self-controlled man is described as follows. Water flows continually into the ocean, but the ocean is never disturbed. Desire flows into the mind of the seer, but he is never disturbed. The seer knows peace. The man who stirs up his own lusts can never know peace. He knows peace who has forgotten desire. He lives without craving, free from ego, free from pride. The worldly person may think that the peace of the seer is like the peace of the grave. On the contrary, it is an experience of supreme and abiding joy, compared to which the short-lived satisfactions known in the sense life appear insipid and worthless. If we wish to find lasting peace and happiness, we must turn to God. The more we devote ourselves to Him, the more the desire for sense gratification will leave us.